Item 1298, require disclosure of energy performance ratings for residential single-family buildings when listed for sale to promote transparency in housing costs and reduction in local carbon emissions.
Good morning. So I'll make some opening comments to set up this discussion, and we obviously have representatives from our bureau here to walk us through this proposal. Just some context, over the last few weeks, we've heard testimony in this chamber about the environment and about climate change and about the need to take local action. And, of course, we've just considered and adopted amendments to our fossil fuel terminal policy that will go into our zoning code if the council approves that, as I hope and expect that we will, hope and expect that we will in 2 weeks. The proposal here before us today is related to that because we have a climate action plan. To put it a little bit lightly, it's not a climate think about it plan. It's not a climate talk about it plan. It's a climate action plan. And I was privileged to vote on the first version of it in 1993 when I was a newly elected city commissioner. And we've been working on those issues for even longer than that, as I think we'll hear from some folks here today. If we're going to get serious about the climate, we have to take local action, and local action is more important than ever. Home energy scores have been a high priority item in that climate action plan since 2009. This is, in effect, low-hanging fruit for us as a city. What can we do in that long list of actions that need to be taken in cities like Portland? Well, energy efficiency is the highest return on investment of all those different action items that we have pledged ourselves to. Home energy scores are a tool that allows local governments and home buyers to have information at their disposal to know what the energy efficiency of a critical purchase actually is. They help consumers understand the full cost of owning a home. The policy will lead to additional investments in energy efficiency projects that will create jobs, reduce carbon emissions, and reduce energy costs for home buyers. A win-win-win. Again, as I said earlier, local action on climate is more important than ever. Portland is one of the C40 cities worldwide that have pledged to climate action, and the West Coast Alliance of Mayors will again meet next month to talk about what can we do at the city level to actually make a difference when we're not sure what the federal government is going to do at their level. So I appreciate the good work that's been done on this plan for many years by the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. We have our Bureau Director and staff here to talk us through the issues in front of us, including the amendments. Maybe I should introduce the amendments first and then turn it over to you for the presentation. So we have some amendments in front of us. Amendment number one amends the ordinance and addresses alternative pathways to exemption or deferral for low-income sellers. It says the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will develop solutions to cover the upfront costs of policy compliance for homeowners who qualify for exemptions or low-income seller deferral. Amendment 2 amends the code and gives the director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability the ability to suspend the policy, saying the director may temporarily suspend or modify the requirements of this chapter based on a determination that such requirements are temporarily infeasible due to economic or technical circumstances. And amendment number 3 amends the ordinance and requires the Bureau to report on market readiness, saying this: no fewer than 2 months prior to the effective date of the City Code Chapter 17.108, the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability will report back to the City Council on the market readiness for policy implementation, including but not limited to the number of home energy assessors licensed, trained, and prepared to meet the market demand for the number of daily home listings on the real estate market. So, again, Susan Anderson and her staff are here to describe the proposed policy. Then we're going to hear from some invited guests and then take public testimony. We're also later in the process going to hear from the City of Austin because they've implemented a similar policy. This is one case in which Portland is not first. We weren't first in bike share, and weren't first in this, but often we're a leader, and I appreciate your leadership. So, Susan, please take
it. Just as a point of clarification, what is the effective date of this, if it's passed?
The effective date will be
January 1st, 2018.
18, right. So
a whole year.
Full
from
year.
Now.
Oh, so let me move the amendments and see if there's a second for those to put those on the table, and then we'll take it away for presentation. And obviously, folks that are here to testify, if you have comments on the amendments as well as on the basic proposal itself, that's why we put those on the table at the beginning of a council session like this. Susan.
Thank you. Good morning, Mayor. Council Susan Anderson, Director of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, and with me here today are Michael Armstrong and Andrea Jacob. I just want to make a few points before I hand it over to them. You'll all remember that last year you adopted a energy score requirement for commercial buildings, and now it's time to do the same for the residential sector. The idea for a home energy score was in the 2009 Climate Action Plan, and the idea behind it, meaning that we needed to work on residential weatherization in ways that only cities can, started with Mike Lindberg, my boss, back in the early 90s. So this has been thought about for more than 20 years, and now with the real estate market as hot as it is now, we think it's time we really need to move on it. An energy score is just like a miles per gallon sticker on a new car or the nutrition label on the food that you buy at the store. And not only have we gotten used to these labels, we've really come to expect them and we rely on them. And that's because clear, credible information is worth something. It helps us to make good choices and to spend our money wisely. An energy score is also a bit like a walk score, and you've all heard about walk scores. It's the label so that people can understand and find walkable neighborhoods, neighborhoods that have amenities like stores and shops and other things close by. But unlike a walk score, where if you like the house but you don't like the walk score, you can't go and pick up the house and move it to the neighborhood that has a better walk score. With an energy score, if you don't like it, you can do something about it. With the information you get from an energy score assessment, you can make simple improvements that will yield significant savings. As the mayor mentioned, some of us have been working on this for a long time, and I've been doing efforts around planning and sustainable urban development and climate change for 30 years now. And this is totally the kind of specific action that really only cities can take. In Oregon, unlike California or Washington, we can't do a more stringent energy code. So California, Washington cities can actually set a more stringent energy code if they want to do that for new construction. And unlike Seattle or Los Angeles or Tacoma or Eugene, we don't own the electric utility, so we don't get to decide what's in the mix in terms of renewable sources in our electricity. So we can do this, though, and also, as the mayor said, we can't rely on the federal government right now to take action on climate change in a big way. So cities around the world know that they have to be the leaders. I also know that this isn't the flashiest project we've ever brought to you. It's not like a big solar project. It's not, you know, electric vehicles, a new light rail line, a new cool bridge that's for transit and bikes only, but energy efficiency, even though it's kind of boring and it's kind of invisible and it's in the walls and it's, you know, in the attic insulation, energy efficiency is the workhorse. It's the absolute cheapest way to cut our carbon footprint. And as the mayor also mentioned, with the fossil fuel export policy, we're limiting supply and we're also making a big statement for Portland about fossil fuels. But we have to do more than just make big statements. We have to keep working on reducing demand, or we absolutely won't meet our goals. Finally, you know, I think in 5 or 6 years, all of this, I'm convinced, will not be a big deal. Cities all over the world will have energy scores. Others are working on it right now. It'll just be the normal thing when you do an exchange in terms of buying a new home. But we're Portland, and we should be in a leadership position. It's why people move here. It's why people move their businesses here. Being a green, a smart, high-performance city is part of who we are. So I'm going to turn it over to Michael and Andrea, and then we'll hear all the testimony, and we'll be available to answer questions.
Great. Thanks. Thank you very much. Good morning.
All right. Mayor and Commissioners, I'm Michael Armstrong with the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And I think we're set with the slides up there.
Okay.
So as both the mayor and Susan noted, this is a kind of fundamental building block in the 2015 Climate Action Plan. And, you know, if we need any reminder of the urgency of taking action on climate, just this weekend The Economist reported on the latest temperature numbers, and that little red line at the top is the limit of temperature increase that the international community is striving to achieve under the Paris Agreement in order to keep the climate stable. We're eaten up all the breathing room we have, and so it's really hard to overstate how urgent action is. So reducing energy use in existing buildings is a really key building block of the Climate Action Plan. As Susan noted, we took action on the commercial sector last year with energy performance ratings. That's the red slice of the pie. The blue one, the next really big one, is residential. Commercial energy benchmarking was action 1A in the climate plan. What's in front of you today is 1B. This is the next big thing that the city can do to reduce emissions from buildings. A similar action was proposed in the 2009 Climate Action Plan, and at the time there was discussion about this is a great policy. We need to be prepared to make it easy for homeowners who want a better score to finance and or arrange with a contractor to reduce the energy use in their home. And so that's what led to the creation of Clean Energy Works, became Clean Energy Works Oregon, and today is Inhabit, a nonprofit organization that exists specifically to connect access to financing, qualified contractors, get the work done in as easy a fashion as possible. We now have that infrastructure. There are good options for people who want to improve their score to do so. And so at the time, there was caution about moving forward until we have this. We now have it. They've helped improve the energy performance in about 5,000 houses since they were created. It's fantastic. We still have about 90,000 houses in Portland that have little to no insulation. So we've made progress. We have a long way to go. And it really does have consequences to household budgets. So here are three representative houses. These are not extreme examples. And so you can see the annual energy cost in three fairly typical houses can vary easily by a factor of 2 to 1. So $1,000 a year on the low end, perhaps $2,000 on the high end. If you think about our housing stock, it lasts 50, 80, 100 years. That $1,000 difference a year, year after year after year, and it may not be the household that's living in it today, but some household is going to benefit from those improvements over time. So this really is something we need to anticipate, not just how it plays out today, but how it plays out over time. So this policy then is intended to help reveal the full cost of owning a home. It's intended to enable an apples-to-apples comparison, so very much like the miles per gallon rating. It helps people understand possible home improvements in advance of the purchase. And it also now can give a home buyer access to specialized mortgage products. FHA, Fannie, and Freddie all have mortgage options that are specific to houses that have a home energy score. So they know whether there's an improvement that's needed, or perhaps it's a high-performing house, and therefore their energy bills are going to be lower, and that gets factored into the mortgage. So we really are in a different position, and lots of support in other organizations and institutions to make good use of policies like this. So I'm going to turn it over to Andrea to describe the mechanics of the policy, and then we'll keep moving.
Okay. Thank you. Good morning.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, Mayor Hales and Commissioners. I'm Andrea Jacob. I'm a manager of energy programs and policy at the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. So what we're proposing today has two main parts. The first part is that sellers of single-family homes obtain a home energy report, and that includes three main things: the home energy score, which is a number on a scale of 1 to 10, an estimate of the total energy used in the home in a year, and then an estimate of the total cost of that energy. And that can be displayed as a monthly figure or as an annual figure. And we want to make clear that the home energy score that we're proposing, as you've heard, is more like a miles per gallon rating. That's called an asset rating. Utility bills tell you about the household and about the past occupant's behavior, but they do not tell you about the house. And it doesn't allow you to compare house to house on an apples to apples basis. So when you look at miles per gallon, you know actual mileage can vary, but you also get a pretty good idea of what you're getting. Asset ratings are considered best practice in the field, and they are based on a very brief physical inspection of the home. I want to also say that we've aligned very closely with the Oregon Department of Energy around state statute and existing rules on home energy scoring systems and practices. So the second piece is to disclose the information from this home energy report to the City of Portland and to prospective buyers who visit the home while it's on the market. The requirement would apply to sellers and to home builders in the case of newly constructed homes. And we're proposing that the time of disclosure be at or before the time of listing. So in your packets in front of you, you have a sample home energy report. I'm going to walk you through it quickly. We are proposing to use the U.S. Department of Energy's Home Energy Score. That's actually a brand. It's a software tool. This first page is the score sheet. That's the first part of the report. You can see it's a 10-point scale. The average home is a 5. This hypothetical home scored a 3. Its estimated energy costs are $1,600 per year. This particular report also shows you what the cost would be if the home were to move to a 7 to get a higher score. So this report's customizable. We can make it, we can tinker with it, we can make it look how we want, but the idea is that you're starting to see standardization on a very simple 10-point scale that allows that apples-to-apples comparison.
So would it list what changes are needed to get to a 7?
Excuse me?
Would it list what changes are needed to get to a 7?
And I'll get to that. It's the third tab of the report.
And is there any way to get to the 10 on that particular house?
Most homes do not score a 10. It's sort of the ultimate net zero type of home. So most homes score in the 5 to 7 range. So the second tab is really the home facts. This is just a rundown of the existing condition of your home. It'll review the square footage, levels of insulation in your floor, attic, and walls, your efficiency of your heating systems, how much window square footage you have, things like that. And then the third tab is really great. This is the recommendations tab to get to your question, Commissioner Fritz. This is a list. It's basically the roadmap for the seller or the buyer to get to that higher score. And the recommendations are prioritized in order of cost effectiveness. In other words, what are the things you should do first that will save you the most energy for the lowest cost? So moving on to exemptions, best practice would suggest that home energy scoring policies really limit the number of exemptions that we have, but as a result of stakeholder engagement and public comment, it became clear that some exemptions were going to be necessary. I also want to point out that this policy is triggered when a home is put on the market for sale. So if a home is not hitting the market, if it's going from a family member to a family member, it's not covered and the policy doesn't get triggered. But for those homes that are going on the market, we did exempt those transactions that were legally or financially complicated. And there's a list here, homes that are in foreclosure or short sales or auction, receivership. A full list of the exemptions is on page 5 of Exhibit A. That's the code language. The proposal also gives the director of the Bureau discretion to exempt sellers for other reasons other than these.
I know there was an amendment just proffered that deals with low income.
Yes.
So what about low income sellers?
I'm going to get right to that. This is the next slide. That's a good question. So also in response to public comment about equity concerns and potential harm to vulnerable residents, we have proposed this low income seller deferral. So the circumstances that would trigger that are listed. So income at or below 60% of median household. Participation in the program we call LIHEAP, it's the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, participation in free and reduced price meals. We also give the director discretion to give a deferral for other reasons. In this case, the requirement would transfer to the buyer, who would have to comply within 4 months. So the amendment deals with this notion that if you get an exemption or a deferral and the score is not then publicly available, like every other home that is going through as complying with the policy, that might allow lenders to do some predatory lending practices against those homes. It might signal that these are homes that are in some kind of difficulty. So the amendment is to direct the Bureau to come up with ways to cover the upfront cost so that everybody can get a score. We'd rather have everybody have a score than have exemptions and deferrals, but we want to create different pathways. So you can get an exemption or deferral, or we're going to try to figure out a way with our partners to cover the cost, which you'll hear is not a significant cost to get to obtain the score.
And then what if the buyer is low income?
Then they will have the same options. We've written the code so that they could take advantage of one of the exemptions as well, or a deferral.
If the point is to help buyers compare between one house and another, what on earth is the point of having it after they've already moved in?
This would be at time of listing. So the score goes into the listing as it goes on to the market, not after they've moved in.
Right.
Oh, but if the buyer, yeah. So what we know about buyers is that they are very motivated, and that within that first few months they're in the home, they make a lot of changes to the home, and they'll have the report and they'll have the roadmap, and the idea is that they could still go ahead and make those upgrades based on the information from the score. It's not ideal, but it's a way of at least providing that information to those folks, and we don't expect there to be that many of these cases.
And this is, in effect, your backup plan.
Correct.
For what you'd actually prefer, which is get some foundation or third party or whoever to fund the cost for low-income buyers up front so they get the same information for low-income sellers up front.
Right. I think in that case we should take out the bit of that. I think that's what we need to figure out is how to get it up front. Because
right.
adding a burden to the buyer when they might be, you know, busy doing whatever else they're doing to move into the house, it doesn't seem to make the point to me.
Agreed. Okay.
So. Just one other question. What if it's highly likely that the home is going to be demolished? There wouldn't seem to be much point in having an energy score if we know that they're going to be more homes or new homes on the same on the lot.
Yeah, we've thought about that, and we know some houses will get sold and then demolished, but we don't think there's value in creating some kind of exemption, and often the seller doesn't know what the buyer is going to do with the house, and they don't know who's going to buy it. And so because the seller will already have gotten the score, you know, we don't have a way to anticipate what will end up happening to the house because it depends on who buys it.
Maybe we could have a rebate by the demolisher. You have to pay to the seller back. It's not a big disincentive, but at least it would be something, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
And just one final point on the deferral and the exemption. We are just asking folks to submit notification. There is no requirement that they wait for an answer from the city before they list the home. They can continue with the transaction, so this should not delay the transaction. So a little bit about our public process and how we got here today. Mayor Hales asked us to start investigating this very late last year, around December of 2015. So we kicked off 2016 with a research and scoping phase. Kyle Deesner, who's in the policy analyst, is in the audience, and he did the lion's share, the majority of all of this work. And we spoke to a lot of other cities. So we looked at energy disclosure policies in Austin, Boulder, Berkeley, Santa Fe, Denver, Chicago, New York, Seattle, D.C. There's a longer list. Just to let you know that there are other cities doing this, other states doing this in different iterations, different formats, but we talked to all of them. We looked at energy efficiency best practices. There is research on this, and looked at data and gathering market trends. And then the public stakeholder engagement process kicked off in May. And we started with two professionally run consumer focus groups. We were behind the glass. These were people who had recently been in the real estate market or planning to be in the real estate market. We segmented the group by home value, the value of the homes that they were purchasing. So a lower home value group and a higher home value group. Very fascinating discussion. But for when everybody put their buyer hat on, almost unanimously, the focus groups were very, very in favor. Some of the concerns we've addressed were a lot about fairness and equity, and so we've tried to address those in the policy design. We also had two facilitated discussions with industry in late May that included the real estate community, the energy efficiency community, lenders, people in the associated fields with real estate. We did have an equity stakeholder group, and that was with community-based organizations representing low-income communities, tenants, communities of color, the Housing Bureau, Multnomah County, and others. We did do individual meetings. We did go and meet with the Portland Metro Association of Realtors at their place of business. We met with others on a one-on-one basis, and that led up to the release of a public comment draft in September. We had a public comment period for several weeks. We got about 800 comments. Close to 600 of those were from realtors. We then took more, we released a public a code language draft in October, took more public comment, and then filed in early November with what you see in front of you. Just to summarize a little bit quickly around the main themes of public comment, as I mentioned earlier, there were a lot of concerns about equity. How does this policy affect low income and vulnerable people like elders on fixed incomes? The Bureau definitely shared that concern, and I think you're seeing that in the policy design with the low income deferral, with the exemptions, with the amendment. We want to make sure this doesn't have negative impacts. We also pushed pause on the rental market. It was our initial idea to have this be applied to single-family rental homes, but we heard clearly from those equity stakeholders that now is not the right time for that, so we pulled that. A closely related concern was housing affordability, this fear that this policy would exert upward pressure on housing costs. So just a couple quick thoughts on that. This is information policy. We are not requiring upgrades at this time. People are paying these energy costs whether or not we shine a light on them, so those costs exist. The cost to obtain the score is about $200. It's within reach for most of the people transacting in the market at this time. But the most important point is that energy efficiency is our most cost-effective long-term housing affordability strategy that we have. Energy efficiency lowers the operating cost of a home over the life of the home, and as Michael showed you, can save thousands of dollars for homeowners or renters should it come to that part of the market. We heard a strong preference among realtors for voluntary market, for incentives. We don't need mandatory. I just want to note that we have been in a voluntary market environment since 2007, 2008, 2009. The state started looking at this. Less than 2% of homes in Portland have gotten a score in that time. So we just need to substantially accelerate the good activity that's already happened. And then lastly, we did have support in the public comment, quite a bit of it, and in the focus groups, and in the unscientific Portland Business Journal poll that showed 67% of people supported this. But the consumer protection and climate protection benefits are recognized by most people that we've talked to about this. So people understand the value of knowing what the full cost of owning a home is. And I'll just sum up two comments from our focus group participants, which I thought were very insightful. One gentleman said, yes, this has to be mandatory. I would never do this if it were voluntary, but I would happily do it if it were mandatory. And the second person said, this policy really helps you see inside the walls. And as Susan said, you know, we label, rate, and score everything that we consume, from food to movies to appliances to cars, but we just don't have anything for homes, and this fills that gap. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions?
Mayor, I have three. Thank you for an excellent presentation. So the disclosure to the city, what will we do with the data when we get it? How will we track outcomes? And is there a budget ask associated with that?
I'll take the last one. There's no budget ask related to this. So we have this as part of our existing budget as a priority.
So
does that include covering the upfront cost for low-income homeowners?
The low-income one, well, mostly you're going to have to rely on me and how I've done in the past 15 years at raising money from foundations and others to be able to pay for this. I think it's a really fundable investment, and I think that we have a lot of partners who will want to be a part of this. But obviously we'll have that in place before this goes live a year from now.
So I guess thank you. And the other two pieces are the disclosures made to the city, what do we do with it, and how do we track outcomes?
The first piece is we would like to put this on Portland Maps, where we house similar information like permit information, permit data, so we think that's a good place for it. We do have an evaluation plan, and the ordinance does direct us to come back in 30 months and report on rates of compliance, uptake in energy efficiency, a range of other outcomes.
Second question. Amendment 3 says, Susan, you could come back to us to talk to us about market readiness and other conditions. We had a conversation last year about TNCs, and they have a pricing policy that says at certain times they raise their prices due to market conditions. So we're saying it's roughly $200 an audit, but we're also making a market, and we're not quite sure how that's going to work. So how do we ensure that the $200 doesn't become $500 in the implementation phase?
I'll let these guys answer, but I do know that in Austin, the market is settled out, and it's about $125 to $150. So it actually went the other direction because it when you create a new demand, you create a new marketplace for a lot of people to enter into that space, and that caused some competition, and the price is now like around $125, $150.
So I think you'll hear testimony from some folks in the audience who are in the industry where even today, without the policy, there is the capacity and the number of qualified home energy assessors to do the work. You'll also notice Amendment 2 gives the director of BPS the authority to temporarily suspend the rules. So if we learn that prices have spiked, we have the ability, or Susan has the ability, to suspend those rules. So we're trying to protect against that, even though even today we understand that there is plenty of capacity in the market to meet the demand.
Should we be considering a requirement that the market participants disclose to you annually what their fees and charges are? Mm-hmm. So you can track that rather than getting it anecdotally?
I would say that might be interesting to hear from some of the other testifiers about.
Okay. And the third thing has to do with Amendment 1. And I appreciate the work you've done already to exempt classes of people, and I appreciate the work you're doing on waivers and deferrals. The thing that I've learned with the utilities, because we have a bunch of programs that offer discounts, waivers, and the like, is that in order for these to work, they have to be as simple as possible. And so what I want to put a plug in for as you develop these options, please don't come up with a system that requires someone to certify, produce tax returns, go through all this stuff. Instead, let's piggyback off of the existing programs, and that's sort of the flavor that you've already done. And so that if someone's already eligible for a program, a precondition of which is their low income, let's piggyback off of that and figure out the fraud issues later. Let's not have someone have to reapply, because the more paperwork at the front end, the less likely that people will be able to take advantage of those things. And I think I made a list, which I'll share with you later, of what are other existing programs that low-income homeowners might be eligible for. So I'd hope we can get as robust a list as possible. And just, and if someone checks a box and they have some reasonable basis for it and they sign a document, that will be deemed sufficient rather than some kind of certification process. Because that will discourage people from taking advantage of it. So thank you.
Other questions?
Yeah, I'm a little hung up on this requirement when a low-income seller sells to another person, that person within 4 months must complete a home energy audit. I mean, I just don't know how you possibly enforce that. Are we talking about putting a lien on a home as a result of that? So how is it enforceable, and what is the wisdom behind it? I guess it's not leaping out at me.
Well, the wisdom is mostly around...
Well, talk about enforcement first.
Okay.
What's the consequences to the buyer that does not complete a home energy audit within 4 months of purchasing a home?
So we're not going to place a lien on anyone's house because they didn't get a home energy score, but we will, the buyer will need to submit to the city the home energy score, much as the seller would have done had the seller done so. And so we will be able to look at the list of, we'll know who submitted a score, we'll know which houses transacted, and then we'll know which houses didn't have a score before they listed, transacted, and then we'll know to follow up with them. And so it will be, typical of city compliance. We'll notify them. Often people don't know or sort of choose not to know. And then we will proceed to sort of escalate that you do need to do this. And so it mirrors a lot of the other enforcement that the city does. But we will have there'll be a process of being able to check who did and didn't.
Who's doing the actual enforcement?
BPS will, Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. And that's part of the program that we need to build in order to make this as easy as possible for everyone to work within.
So a couple follow-ups perhaps to that that might be helpful both to Commissioner Saltzman and the rest of us. That is, you have done a bunch of research on what other cities have done. It might be useful for us, not now verbally, but in writing maybe, how have other cities handled this issue? And then what has been the enforcement bandwidth or the scale of the problem with respect to the commercial energy benchmarking that we're already doing, because that might be a precedent for, how often is this going to happen?
Right. I think the enforcement on this one, I mean, it's a little bit of money, and the average price of a house right now is, heading towards $400,000. In the transaction of, $200 for doing this is small, and I understand it may not be small to someone who is low income at the time of sale. But so in terms of actually enforcing it, this is going to rely on a great partnership with the realty community over time. And it's not going to happen unless the real estate agents, of course, just like other things that they have to do on those 94 pages that you sign when you buy a new house or a house. And so my hope is that just like we have other kinds of enforcement issues, that we have partners with all of the construction industry currently and, with building codes. We don't go out and check every single thing they do. We couldn't do that. It wouldn't be cost effective. It's going to rely on us building a great partnership with the real estate community over time to understand that this is something that's the rule here in Portland.
So just to reiterate what Michael said, there's no envisioning liens on people's homes under this. None whatsoever. Okay.
Other questions? Thank you very much. I know we'll probably need you back up for more questions at the end of the hearing. So we're going to open the public hearing, and we have some invited testimony first, and then we'll move into folks on the sign-up sheet. First, I believe we have Senator Michael Denbrough and former Senator Jackie Dingfelder here. We'll extend the courtesy to the elected officials and former elected officials in the room. Welcome. And I don't know if there are any others, but I think these two are here. They are here. Good morning.
Morning.
Good morning. Welcome back.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Mayor and council members. My name is Jackie Dingfelder, a former state senator, former policy director for the mayor, and I live in Northeast Portland. And it's I want to thank you all for holding the hearing today on this very important proposal before us. As Susan said, it's truer than ever that the fight against climate change will be won or lost in states and cities, as we all know. And with this proposal, you have the opportunity to take a critical step forward on climate change while enabling homebuyers in Portland to make better decisions for their pocketbooks. At the state, I helped pass legislation that established a state certification for people trained to provide home energy scores. Stakeholders from across the state have now agreed on which rating system to use. All the pieces are now in place to move forward to make home energy score standard practice. Unfortunately, we've seen that voluntary efforts aren't enough, as you've heard from the BPS staff. You may be hearing from realtors today who want you to take a go slow approach. They say they support the city's climate and affordability goals, but oppose a requirement. I have good friends who are realtors, we all do, and know that they are sincere, but we simply can't afford to delay. And by the way, this is the exact same argument I heard several years ago when I proposed the same bill in the state legislature. So more than ever, home buyers need to understand the full cost of owning a home, including the energy costs. Let me share with you a recent example that made me think even more about why this is needed. Unfortunately, my trusty Subaru of 16 years is starting to wear down, and I started looking for a new car, and I thought, okay, there's been a huge amount of improvements on energy efficiency. We have new hybrids. So I started looking at new cars and, of course, comparing the fuel efficiency. And it occurred to me that one of the biggest choices in our life is buying a home. I know it was for me, lived in the same home for 23 years, but it's a huge investment for all of us. But it is one of the least informed choices that we make around energy. And you think about the amount of energy that you are going to use over the lifetime of a house, yet we don't really have good metrics or a way to compare when we're looking at different homes. And so while I was out car shopping, it made me think a lot about how we have this great requirement that car sellers have to disclose fuel efficiency, yet we don't have that type of opportunity for people to make informed choices when they're buying a home. And we all know that energy costs are a huge part of our monthly costs to run our home and make sure that we have a warm and safe environment. So we do need to make sure that this proposal can work for low-income sellers. I know that you're working out the details on that. And so I would encourage you to make sure that, obviously, low-income sellers have the same opportunities and low-income buyers to make that comparison. I know that Susan Anderson and her team are very concerned about equity and will work very closely with the council to address those concerns. In closing, I just want to mention I spent much of the past year working and living in New Zealand and had the benefit of a global perspective on climate change. New Zealand takes climate change very seriously as well. You probably know they're an island nation, and issues around sea level rise is something that they thought about every day. People look at the U.S., and they're very worried about where we're headed. But they also look at cities like Portland, and they see, you know, real promise. Wherever I went in New Zealand, people asked me where I was from. They said, City of Portland. Oh, we look to Portland as a model here in New Zealand in many of our cities. Certainly, I think that's true throughout the world. So more than ever, we need Portland to lead, and this is an important opportunity to do so with a practical and a reasonable approach that helps Portland families and reduces carbon at the same time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll hand it over to my esteemed colleague.
Good morning.
Thank you, Senator. Mayor Hales, commissioners, I'm Michael Dembro. I represent Senate District 23, that's Northeast, Southeast Portland, in the Oregon Senate, where I also sit on the Energy and Environment Committee. And I'm here primarily to address the potential charge that a program like this really should be a state program as opposed to being dealt with at the local level. I believe that it absolutely needs to be addressed at the local level. And to sort of give some background to that, you need to know that the day after the election, a couple of weeks ago, I had the dubious pleasure of flying to Washington, D.C., to be part of a conference on energy policy and climate change. That this was, it's a cohort of legislators from around the country, bipartisan. It's an institute called the Lehigh Institute, the Legislative Energy Horizons Institute, sponsored by a combination of funders from the fossil fuel industries, from renewable fuels, from different policy think tanks. And it was, I have to say, the day after the election, it was both sobering, but also, you know, I think ultimately very, very realistic. And the theme that really came through day after day was that the action on climate change really is going to, the action on climate action has been and will continue to be primarily at the local level, whether we're talking about the states or we're talking about cities. And that will be true even more so likely under the new administration. And the other message that came through very clearly was the importance of energy efficiency, and that in order to reach our climate goals, states, cities, the country as a whole really needs to double down on energy efficiency. There's been a lot of work that's been done in different states and different locales around the country. A lot of low-hanging fruit has been picked, and progress has been made. But there is much, much more to be done. And we heard that probably the strongest voice for that was the representative from BP Oil, who was talking to us about the importance of energy efficiency as part of their growing portfolio. And, you know, what we also heard, you know, there was, of course, with legislators there from around the country, we all were sort of elbowing as to who's doing good work in what area and what areas. And, you know, we did learn that Oregon as a whole has slipped in the last year or so in terms of its energy efficiency, its standing among the states with respect to energy efficiency. So it really is important that that we heard specifically about the need to focus on innovative programs like residential scorecards. That was something that was mentioned, again, in a very, you know, nonpartisan kind of way, that this is the cutting edge of where we need to be going in terms of energy efficiency. So, you know, I really encourage you to pursue this. You know, just looking at the turnout here, obviously this is a local issue. And having this addressed at the local level allows people on all sides of this issue with concerns and suggestions to come together in a very easy way that really could not happen at the state level. You know, just as with respect to the country as a whole, we see the states as the laboratories of change where the states can try things out and become models for one another. So the cities serve that same function with respect to the states. You know, we heard about Austin and what a model Austin has been. If that had been left up to the state of Texas, clearly, you know, we would not, Texas is not going to be a laboratory on this issue. But Austin can be, and it can provide us with useful information and models, just as this city will for Salem, for Corvallis, for Eugene, for Redmond, for Bend, for other cities in this state. So I encourage you to move forward in pursuing this program.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate you being here. So we have a few other pieces of invited testimony. Chris Smith is here representing our Planning and Sustainability Commission, our volunteers who help us make policy. Thank you very much. And then we have a video presentation from the U.S. Department of Energy. So, Chris, welcome. Good morning.
Mayor, members of council, thank you. I am Chris Smith, Vice Chair of the Planning and Sustainability Commission, here to convey the commission's support for this program. We reviewed this under the sustainability part of our name, and as such, this was not a formal legislative project for us, so we did not hold a public hearing. We did, however, receive unsolicited input from both sides of the issue. As you can see in the room, there's a lot of passion on both sides, and they were happy to help inform our deliberations. Some of the issues that we discussed in our review included the provisions for low-income homeowners, and I think we were largely satisfied that the program has tools to help them. We had discussion of whether a voluntary program or other ways of measuring this, like disclosing energy bills, would be a sufficient alternative. I think you've heard in the staff presentation why this is a better option than those. I guess I'd leave you with two points. One is that we are the custodians of the Climate Action Plan, and this is one of many steps that are going to be required in that plan to get to our climate objectives. So we think this is a necessary step along the way. And finally, I'd comment on the evolving understanding of affordability. It's been during my tenure helping with public policy in the city that we've come to understand that you can't look at isolated factors of affordability. So, for example, you have to look at both the mortgage cost and the transportation costs to really understand the affordability of a home. And I think this is the further evolution that we have to include the energy operating costs in our understanding of affordability. So I think this will help both in the policymaking context and for individual consumers to really understand the affordability of their homes. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. So we do have a video testimony from Joan Glickman from the U.S. Department of Energy, and I think Michael's got that set up for us.
Inviting me to speak. I am Joan Glickman, a senior advisor at the U.S. Department of Energy and manager of the Home Energy Score program. The U.S. DOE created the Home Energy Score to serve as a credible national standard for communicating how much energy a home is expected to use and how that home compares to others. The score is based on an assessment of homes' assets that affect its energy use, like heating and cooling equipment, insulation, and square footage. By applying standard assumptions about weather and occupants, the score reflects how much energy the home will use under average conditions. Based on 50,000 homes scored to date, we found that homes of all shapes and sizes score across the 10-point spectrum. Older homes are not disadvantaged by the score, as we have found no strong correlation between vintage and score. Just like a miles per gallon sticker can help consumers take into account a car's long-term operating costs, the score helps home buyers better predict the true cost of homeownership. Providing prospective buyers with a score can help them better understand whether monthly expenses will truly be affordable. This is particularly important for first-time buyers and those in lower income brackets, since utility bills are a larger part of their disposable income. But the score is more than just about predicting bills. It's a way to encourage investment in improving the efficiency of our nation's homes. That's why the score report includes a list of customized recommendations that can save energy and money and often improve comfort. With this information in hand, buyers can insulate the attic or seal the ducts just as they paint and refinish floors when they move in. Some banks will work with borrowers to wrap those improvement costs into the mortgage. In fact, Fannie Mae and FHA offer products that recognize the score to encourage efficiency investments. The score can also help sellers highlight the investments they've already made in energy upgrades by making these improvements readily visible to prospective buyers. At the end of the day, most home buyers are going to purchase a home for a number of reasons not related to energy performance, but providing the score helps them better understand what to expect and can prepare them to make smart choices as a homeowner. I'm happy to answer questions as needed. Thank you. Thank you, Mayor Hales and commissioners, for inviting me.
Thank you. Ready. She's ready to repeat it if we need her to. Thank you very much. Our final two invited speakers are Michael Colgrove from Energy Trust of Oregon and Charity Fain from Community Energy Project. So come on up if you're here, and then we'll move into the sign-up sheet after that. Welcome.
Is there somebody from Austin who's here too?
We have some later, but I think we'll hear testimony first. not here in person, just videos. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning. So good morning, Mayor Hales, commissioners. Thank you for the invitation to join you this morning to share Energy Trust of Oregon's experience with home energy scoring. For the record, my name is Mike Colgrove, and I'm the executive director of Energy Trust, an independent nonprofit whose sole purpose is to help the 1.5 million customers of Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural, and Cascade Natural Gas save and generate clean and expensive energy. Pursuant to our grant agreement with the Oregon Public Utility Commission, Energy Trust does not support or oppose ballot measures, candidates, or matters before the City Council. I am here this morning to provide information on our experience with home energy scoring and not to advocate for a specific outcome related to this proposed ordinance. At its essence, home energy scoring is a way to increase the transparency regarding a new or existing home's energy use. We have found scoring to be an effective strategy for increasing the number of homes built at least 10% above code, and in the case of existing homes, identifying opportunities for energy upgrades. Energy Trust first began considering home energy scoring in 2007. Since then, we have conducted several pilots and evaluations and issued energy scores for 10,000 new homes and 2,000 existing homes. We have learned how the market responds to these scores and determined that they are effective indicators of how well or poorly a home uses energy. Providing our customers with information and knowledge is a key component of many of our energy conservation programs. Home energy scoring provides homeowners or buyers with a transparent indication of a home's energy usage to help inform decision-making about what is one of the largest purchases of most people's lives. In the absence of a national federal home labeling policy, ordinances such as the one before you today and programs such as those Energy Trust of Oregon implements may be the only tools available to move housing stocks into a more energy-efficient, lower-carbon future. Should the City of Portland choose to adopt the Home Energy Score Ordinance, Energy Trust stands ready to help homeowners and home builders comply, much as we did when the City passed the Commercial Energy Performance Reporting Policy last year. We have also helped to build market capacity by supporting education and training opportunities for the people who will carry out these assessments and implementing energy efficient upgrades. While we believe there is currently sufficient capacity to service the existing market, we could support additional training to accommodate any increased demand which the ordinance might generate. I'd be happy to respond to any questions now or to provide supporting documentation upon request.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Good morning.
Good morning. Mayor Hales and commissioners, thank you so much for the opportunity to testify. My name is Charity Fain, and I'm the executive director of the Community Energy Project. We at CEP believe that everyone deserves a safe, healthy, and efficient home, regardless of income. We help vulnerable and underserved Portlanders weatherize their homes, make critical safety repairs, and we teach people how to do this themselves. Last year, nearly two-thirds of our clients identified as people of color, and all of our clients were low income. CEP strongly supports the proposed Home Energy Score program. For lower income home buyers, knowing the potential heating and cooling costs is essential when considering whether a mortgage will be affordable. And while the price of homes increasingly becomes unaffordable to many, making this information public is of particular value to low income buyers. The energy audits required by the program will provide home buyers with a list of suggested upgrades to improve efficiency and reduce utility costs. And for home buyers like our clients, this information will help them to prioritize projects, and it is also an immense value to them. Some of our clients might also be sellers, and as we have discussed, may not have the resources to pay for the required audits. CEP participated in the equity stakeholder meetings with the city and expressed those concerns with them. We feel that they listened to us and incorporated the exemption process into the proposed program. We believe the provisions are sufficient to alleviate potential burdens on lower income home sellers. Finally, like many others, I really want to address climate change. At this time, it's absolutely critical that we move forward with Portland's climate action plan. The proposed program, as we know, will provide home buyers and sellers with the information they need to prioritize efficiency upgrades. But I think what's even more important to consider is that while we will all benefit as Portland homes become more efficient, we won't all be equally impacted by climate change. CEP's clients and vulnerable people everywhere will bear a disproportionate burden to climate change, and we need to think about this and develop programs to address it. On behalf of CEP and our clients, I ask you to support the Home Energy Score program.
Thank you. Questions?
I have a question for either or both. One of the things I've learned as a consumer is that from time to time, reputable agencies that do things like scores get it wrong. And the best example is a credit score. And it required a congressional intervention to then get to the point where we have a right to see our credit scores and we get to have some relief. And when it turns out that there's something on our credit score that is an unrelated charge or problem, if they've mixed and matched, there's a remedy for getting that cleaned up and have your score fixed. If a homeowner disagrees with a home energy score or report, what is the recourse for that homeowner? And I'll give you an example. I could imagine a situation where there's two reports that have been generated, a home energy score and a report that has home facts, and a standard home inspection that's usually done by the buyer. What happens if you can't reconcile the two, and it turns out that there's a mistake on one or both? How does that get fixed, and where's the recourse?
You might be better at that.
Sure. I don't want to speak for the staff of the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability, but it's my understanding that any types of discrepancies like that can be taken to the director for resolution. I will say that the Energy Trust plays a role in the quality control aspect of the types of organizations and companies that perform these ratings. So we do have a level or an obligation there to ensure that the folks, at least working through Energy Trust, maintain certain levels of quality control, and conflict resolution. But I would think the specific resolution or conflict would be brought to the department or division of BPS.
So my guess is that when you said that it would go to Susan to be adjudicated, she was breaking out in hives. So let's assume Susan.
We're maybe not the best people to ask.
Because I don't think anyone would view that as a satisfactory process. So someone gets their score, and it says it has roof, attic one, some description, and they're like, well, that's funny. I live in a bungalow that has no attic. So somehow this got grafted on. This isn't my house. Or it says that windows have failed and you just replace it. A million things can happen. And the only reason I know this is because all of us have spent time cleaning up our credit scores, which, by the way, is an important score for lots of reasons, only to find out that there's misinformation on it. So because this is a fluid situation and you're going to want to reconcile any discrepancies quickly, what is the official appeal process within your agency to have that resolved?
Within our agency, so if the homeowner is applying to Energy Trust for incentives or anything on the types of improvements they might be doing, or working with a specific contractor that's providing the report, and they have an issue and we're involved in that in some way, we have a very formal conflict. We have a hotline you can call if you have an issue with any of our contractors. You can bring that forward. We review all of those complaints on a regular basis to help ensure, and then reach back out and for resolution. Now, if we are, like I said, if the project is going to improvement where actual measures are being installed, we are involved on the ground working with doing inspections and follow-up.
I'd like to also add that we provide, I think, something that can help is education around what that score is and what you might expect in an audit. I went through one. It can be very confusing even when you know something about the industry. And people can come and get some free education on what do you look for, how do you better understand what your information that's going to be provided to you. And we as an organization provide those free trainings for anyone in the community. So, you know, sometimes it's understanding what you're getting. It might not be a mistake in the audit. You might just not totally understand the audit.
Yeah.
So, like, looking for those resources that already exist in the community to understand. And I can also just speak from, as a homeowner, you know, when you're working with whatever contractor that's coming in, they are really responsive. and you know that they can go over it with you and help you. Having that information in advance so that you really understand kind of the technical language makes a huge impact on what you understand in that audit. And those resources, like I said, exist already. But as to what the official policy is, I'm a community rep, so I don't know.
Well, I appreciate your answers, and I think later on when the team comes back, we'll talk about, this is a pro-consumer measure, obviously. And I also want to just make sure that the consumer has recourse if someone along the chain gets it wrong. That's all. And so it's not another hoop without a remedy.
Absolutely.
Question. Good. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you both very much. Appreciate you being here and appreciate you being resources for this work. Okay.